All Productions with Studio Production Today by Lyndon Jones.
On BBC Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, a birthday celebration of one of American minimalism's founding fathers, Steve Reich. In a late-night prom on BBC Radio 3, Ensemble Moderne join forces with Synergy Vocals and Steve Reich himself to perform some of his most celebrated works, including the first-ever prom's performance of Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. Steve Reich comes to the 2011 BBC Proms, Wednesday night at 10:15 on BBC Radio 3.
It's just gone midday. Time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Simon Hopkinson is that rare thing, a food writer who creates recipes that you feel you can actually make and that you really want to eat. Simon was a chorister at St John's, Cambridge. At 17, he worked in a French restaurant in Lancashire. He was an inspector for Egon Rone. A friendship with the Conrans led him to cooking at and partially owning Bibendum. In 1994, he published his widely acclaimed Roast Chicken and Other Stories. And currently, his series, The Good Cook, is on BBC One with a new book to accompany it. Music and food, that sounds like a pretty good combination.
Well, yes, growing up with music and very good cooking from both parents. My mother was very good. I can't say plain cook because it tasted delicious, and plain cooking sometimes doesn't have connotations of things that are delicious. But she made wonderful rabbit pie, not something you see these days, and jugged hare even. But to her generation, you know, those sort of things like game were cheap. I mean, I think probably a rabbit from Berry Market was tuppence or fivepence or something like that in old money. And very good and very thrifty. And when I was learning cooking, hated if I wasted an egg. And would retrieve things that I'd thrown away in disgust because I got it wrong. And I learnt a lot from that. But Dad was the one who loved making exciting things.
I wonder, as somebody that is extremely practical in their advice, as you are, whether you sometimes, as I do, see recipes and you think, oh, come on.
I'm not good at liking a recipe that tells you to have to hand 500 millilitres of strong veal stock. This is not really a criticism. I just don't think it makes for happy cooking unless you're like me and you always have, not veal stock, but I've always got chicken stock. I like cooked duck quite a lot. So I have little pots of very nicely made stock in my freezer. But not many people do. For me, it's not an exception. It's just the rule. No, or it says go to page 250 in a book and it says how to make a veal stock. Read your recipe, obviously. But if you suddenly fancy something, there is that glaring line that says the veal stock.
Roast Chicken, your book, was actually not only very popular with the people that bought it, but it was voted the top book by a lot of other chefs.
Most useful was the description they used, which I thought was rather nice. Yeah. Right time of year, not much news around. End of July, I think it was. 2005, maybe, I think it was. And it did make every single newspaper and provincial paper, just a paragraph or two, but gosh. The book suddenly sold.
It was the practicality, wasn't it, very much, that I think scored, that people feel, and watching your series on BBC One at the moment is, you know, yes, I could do that.
Yes, well, that's what I've always aimed to do. Some people might say, oh, I'd never be bothered to stew onions for 40 minutes to get to the right consistency for a very simple cheese and onion pie, which was my mother's and a great favourite of both my brother and I. But then there are some, you know, long-winded dishes, again, one, curiously, one with onions, with a rolled breast of lamb, which you pop in the oven, there's no liquid, and you pile a kilo of onions to a kilo of lamb, and it cooks, based on an old Elizabeth David recipe with beef, but I thought it'd be lovely with this nice cut of cheap, delicious lamb, and it goes in the oven for 3 hours, but you go and do something else.
Your choice of music has a very definite flavour to it. It's one with which I empathise a lot as speaking as an ex-chorister.
Right. Well, particularly the first one is, I shall never forget the first time I heard it and sang it, which is the Tippett Magnificat from the John Service. It is so exciting. I mean, it was shocking to an eight-year-old's ear. And I remember George Guest, when we did a recital, I think it was at St. David's Cathedral, and I'd just become a chorister from being a probationer and was my first, as it were, recital. We were there for a few days. And he explained to the audience in the cathedral that it was, he always felt the beginning was like a fantastic firework display and this gorgeous introduction, and using the, particularly in John's, the Trompetta Reale, I think is right. They were very exciting to look at and hear. And when it starts, it's so uplifting and very exciting to sing.
Bye.
That's clearly still as thrilling to you, Simon Hopkins.
Absolutely thrilling. At the end, it's just glorious and makes me shiver every time I hear it.
And when you think that as a young boy, taking part in something like that, where you really have to listen to what everybody else is doing, to pitch it.
Yes. I mean, I wasn't a star chorister. I never sang a solo. Very close once, and I never got my shilling, which is what you got. But it was a difficult piece, and George Guest was very particular and not easy to please. Is that the right way of saying it?
I think that'll sum it up. George Guest there conducting the choir of St John's College with Andrew Carwood playing the dynamic organ part in the Tippett Magnificat from the Evening Canticles. It's rather good to see that your musical tastes, Simon Hopkinson, rather as with your cooking, have a preponderance of the best English ingredients.
I do enjoy English music a lot. And I think of a film that a maths master made at the school at St John's. He was very good. He directed little plays. We did the Britain Little Sweep, for instance, things like that. And he used Ireland's Greater Love Hath No Man. He used that as the closing music, I think, to this little film he made at school. And that nearly made this list, but it hasn't. But it was a certain type of English...
Sensibility
and... Oh, one can also put in there a very romantic sound, a very, what I used to think you might almost have called slushy, but in the nicest slushy way, you know, that makes you go all gooey inside.
Well, it's interesting that actually the conductor of the next piece, Daniel Barenboim, is not somebody that you would ever associate with a kind of English pastoral music, although, of course, he conducted famously the Elgar Cello Concerto with his then-wife, Jacqueline Dupré, Daniel Barenboim. This next piece is quintessentially English, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think I remember my mother had this, which is when I first discovered it, on a long-playing record, and it was an assay vinyl. And it was Sir Thomas Beecham. I remember the picture of him in the cover with a white hat and a long white beard, and I loved it.
And, of course, Delius actually spent quite a lot of time in France.
He did, didn't he?
But this piece has come to be sort of almost synonymous with English countryside.
Yes, it's on hearing the first Cuckoo in Spring, and it goes back a long way with me. And we did sing Delius as well with George at John's. I can say George now, I think. I haven't met him since. I remember when my mother first played that to me, she said, see if you can spot the cuckoo, and eventually you do, and the clarinet, and it's very exciting, really, to actually hear the sound of the cuckoo in the music.
And there's a wonderful kind of languorous feel to that. I mean,
oh, yes.
You could be lying in a sort of dappled meadow, couldn't you?
You absolutely could.
On Hearing the First Cuckoo in Spring by Julius, the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. And as I said, just slightly surprising repertoire for him. It's not what we associate with.
No.
Does it? Obviously enjoys it.
Yes, it's a beautiful recording.
Yeah.
One that I haven't heard before, so that's very
exciting.
Actually,
we're going, Simon Hopkinson, through a slight menagerie here, aren't we? Or a little zoo, in fact.
Yes, I know.
Because you found another cuckoo.
I have, Rassan Roland Kirk. But I have to admit that the first recording of this particular composition was by Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, the band that I grew up with, which I still like very much indeed, being the great flautist that he is. But then I discovered that it actually was written by Roland Kirk. I heard him play it live, just the ones with my brother, who knew much more about Roland Kirk than I did, my brother Jerry, and he took me to Ronnie Scott's club in Frith Street in London, where he was performing, and he was a serious performer, this very tall black man with, I think he had a top hat on and a black suit and dark glasses, and I think by then he was half paralysed, but he still managed to play two instruments together, which was something that he was well known for, and he played Serenade to a Cuckoo, and it was wonderful. I've never forgotten that evening, and it was magical to see the man and to hear him play it, and it's a wonderful, wonderful tune. Thank you.
There's something about being at a live performance, isn't there? I mean, it's wonderful having CDs and we can listen to our favourite things, but there's nothing like being, for example, that ambience at Ronnie Scott's.
It's wonderful. And there's those Full of Smoke as well, and this extraordinary looking man on the stage.
And I love that thing, you know, when somebody does something rather wonderful and a sort of simultaneous roar goes up.
Yes.
You know, the audience are in the communion, really, aren't they? Because they're sharing their appreciation for a rather marvellous riff.
Yes. And it's lovely, you know, to hear it live now, and it makes you feel very much part of it and brings back a terrific memory, I must say.
Serenade to a Cuckoo, Rassan Roland Kirk. And we heard Roland Kirk playing the flute with Ron Burton piano, Henry Pete Pearson bass, Robert Shy drums, and Joe Texidor percussion. Well, we move Simon Hopkinson from cuckoos to a cat and a mouse.
Yes. I was actually on this recording. You can't hear me. I remember it very well indeed. And I particularly remember Michael Pierce, the countertenor, or as we always knew them then, just as altos, the choral scholars who were in the choir, altos, tenors and basses. But his voice particularly, although Roger Parker is the treble that begins the two solos, it's a beautiful, gentle voice. But the second one, as you, well, you hear, because there are two such contrasting pieces from Rejoice in the Lamb by Benjamin Britten. It is such a curious piece with this cat Geoffrey and this mouse, and I love it.
But the poems, he was always very good at finding wonderful texts.
Yeah.
For I will consider my cat. It's such a wonderful line, isn't it, Geoffrey?
Yes, yes, yes.
And then the other one is, for the mouse is a creature of great personal valour. I mean, that in itself is so wonderful.
Yes, it's slightly bonkers, but at the same time, it's true.
And well, he was slightly bonkers, actually.
Yes, yes, so, yes.
I think he was even incarcerated.
Yes. And George Guest did talk about it when we were doing it, and he, you know, a bit of strange poetry coming into it, which, you know, he didn't talk down to us about that. It wasn't just the music.
Do you think, in a way, that experience of singing in a choir, you know, at a high level, even if you were just one of the sopranos, as it were.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, it is an extraordinary thing to do at that age, isn't it? Because and then when you're working, for example, with your television series, you're working with a crew.
Yeah.
And there is something, I think, about having had that experience of working together with a team of people.
Well, true. And the discipline, of course. And in fact, the first job I had in school holidays, and then after I'd left school, went to full-time at the restaurant called the Normandy up in Lancashire. And at the beginning, in the first two school holidays that I worked there, the chef Yves Champeau said to Clive Jenkinson, his father-in-law, who was a Salisbury chorister, he said, "This boy seems to just sort of get on with things, and you don't need to tell him things twice." He said, Clive Jenkinson said to Yves Champeau, "Well, he was a chorister, wasn't he?" You know,
that explains it all.
It explains it all.
Yeah. For the mouse is a creature of great personal valour. We heard the countertenor Michael Pearce, and before that, For I Will Consider My Cat Geoffrey, in which we heard the treble Roger Parker. The organist was Brian Runnett, and that was from the recording by the choir of St John's College, Cambridge, conducted by George Guest. The words, of course, were, as you said, Christopher Smart, and in fact, he was actually in an asylum when he wrote those poems.
Of course. Yes.
Rather extraordinary. And what I love about it is, A, that the cat should be called Geoffrey in the first place. It's quite wonderful somehow.
Yes.
And like a lot of madness, there's such a thin line, isn't there, between sort of moments of creative genius and moments that are, well, you think of Schumann, for example, moments you just cannot decipher. Mm. And so there are flashes of genius in this cycle of poems, as well as things that are rather odd.
Yes. Yes.
But I think it was very clever of Britain just to take certain lines.
Which, and put them to such, like, Cat Chase for Your Mouse. It's such a lovely contrast to the first part, which is so gentle and sweet.
To a certain extent, do you think that it's having the imagination just to add that one thing that possibly quite often, or more than one thing, makes cooking such a delight for you? I mean, for example, you brought as a little offering some most delicious cheese biscuits.
Yes.
There was one thing in it, wasn't there, which gives it an extra bite.
A little bit of cayenne and a little bottle of chili flakes, which I buy from a Japanese shop. It's not as hot as very powdery cayenne, but I was sprinkling more than the original recipe said of those. And I have my friend Rachel Cook to thank for those biscuits. And they've done the rounds. They've been around a bit, though, but she was the person who gave me the recipe, and I thank her forever for those, because they're delicious.
But it is that thing which, you know, in music one might summarise in the immortal words of Cole Porter, sort of, how strange the change from major to minor. It's that little thing where you do a sudden twist.
Yes. There are certain things that sometimes wonder why you'd never thought of doing that before. There are some that don't excite me. Fish with vanilla, which became fashionable, if you might use that word, or let's do something unusual and put vanilla with fish, and I've never got that. Although a lot of people, my friend Rick Stein has got it, but I don't get it. But a new dish of aubergines with crumbled feta, done in a particular way that, again, a friend gave me recently, which is, I wish I'd known about this dish for longer.
You're very good on aubergines, actually.
I love aubergines.
You like stroking them and
I love, and I have a collection of ornamental ones at home. But I do love their shape and I love their variety.
And that sort of fondness for very good, simple ingredients, which sometimes are taken for granted. You mentioned Rick Stein. In fact, when he was on the programme, we were actually both extolling the virtues of really fresh mackerel.
Right, yes.
You can't go wrong with it.
You can't go wrong with it, but it's difficult to find, of course.
Yeah, because if the oil goes rancid, it's not nice.
If you're very lucky, sometimes you'll see good mackerel in London, but it's obviously you eat it while you buy the water.
We've been concentrating on English music, but the next piece, Simon Hopkinson, is almost a national anthem now for America.
Yes, it just sounds American. Copland sounds American. It's nothing like it for me. I'm afraid, once more, rather like the Roland Kirk, I first heard a version of this done by Keith Emerson, who had a band called The Nice. Again, it's teenager, away at school.
Was that the Emerson of Emerson
Lake and Palmer? Then became, but the band he had before that was called The Nice. And he think he went to the Royal College of Music, Keith Emerson. He was a fantastic pianist.
Well, the Copland we're going to hear actually conducted by a famous film composer, curiously enough, because it's the London Philharmonic Orchestra playing Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, conducted by Carl Davis.
Thank you.
it is extraordinary how that music, as with some American art, conjures up a kind of open landscape.
Yes, and I think, you know, the open fields, farms, barns. But there is that famous American picture which seems to completely sum up that Grant Wood, I think.
With the pitchfork and the farming.
With the pitchfork.
And the idea that it's for the common man, fanfare for the common man, is a kind of, there's a kind of universality about it, in fact.
Yes. It just says America.
Yeah. Well, and of course, he was very influenced by sort of Shaker music, because he's an Appalachian Spring.
Yes.
And the music does have somehow, in the same way that you were talking about Delius and we were talking about Elgar and people who had a sort of quintessentially English feel, that there is something which does make one feel more, not just because one knows the association, but it just does feel part of that.
It does. It big fields and isolated houses. Mm.
You've mentioned Simon Hopkins and various groups who, curiously, have introduced you to sort of classical pieces. Mm. But you do have a strong love for straightforward jazz and, in some cases, music that's in between the two.
Yes, this next one by Soft Machine, which comes from Soft Machine Third, which I did buy at school. And there's something about a slow burn with certain music that I now really love. If you like working hard at it, I will like this. You know I will like this, but it's taking a while for it to get through. And this is absolutely a case in point. It sounds like they're using reverse tapes, but it's quite a long build-up, which is too long, but there is part of it, and then it does go into the actual song. And it's the rhythm that I love. A lot of music I like is with triplets and with offbeat and syncopated, and it takes concentration. And not difficult, but... very, very interesting.
So almost Dave Brubeck kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm sure they're hugely influenced. But once the actual tune starts going, it just takes you with it.
Thank you. That was part of Out Blood Rages by Soft Machine. Do you think that your ability to do this television series, and I know at first you didn't see yourself, did you,
as
a television pundit?
Go away. Go away.
Which makes it even nicer that it's been such a success. But, I mean, I remember David Hockney talking about painting and saying that really you need to be able to draw before you use oils. You need to know the rules before you break them. And do you think those early years when you worked in kitchens and then at Bibendum was what really gave you the confidence, if you like, to be the person you are now?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you're constantly learning. I think there's a lot of running before walking these days. Obviously, you know, a lot of young chefs just want to be famous chefs, if you like, or celebrity chefs. I hate the terminology of all that and the celebrity in general, but it's... There is a lot of running before walking and, you know, learn to make a perfect stock, learn to bone meat, bone fish, do all the stuff that makes it, interesting, but also it means you can do so much more. But one of the things I did do for 3 years was to work in a private house, which was fantastic because I had a much freer rein. I could concentrate. I had time to evolve dishes, actually. And both the Roux brothers did similar things. And they've always said that it's a very good thing to have done, to work in a private house.
Well, I remember, for example, Nadia Boulanger's composition class in Paris, and she taught lots of people, and people like Bernstein, Copland, my father, in fact, were very influenced by her. And she wouldn't let composers write a note of their own music before they could write in the style of Bach, counterpoint, polyphony and things like that, because she thought you needed that technique before you did your own thing.
The building blocks, really,
absolutely.
I suppose. Yeah.
Fascinating that you've chosen now a piece that I absolutely adore. And why I say fascinating is because Olivier Messiaen is a composer who has a very deep-rooted religious conviction.
Yes.
And yet, actually, this is about the only piece I think he wrote, which is for a choir.
I don't have very much Messiaen. And it is a particular piece that goes back to, I think, George Guest. I think it was towards the end of my time there. We all found it incredibly difficult.
It's difficult to pitch, isn't it?
Difficult to pitch because it's all so very close together. And getting the tempo...
Because it needs to be quite slow.
It does need to be quite slow. And it is a real memory piece, this, because it was one of the very last pieces I sung before my voice broke as well.
Just before we hear it, it is, I think, worth reflecting on how, in so many of the things we've talked about, the Copland, for example, that space between the notes.
Mm. Yes.
And this is true in great actors as well, for example, isn't it? That having the confidence to breathe. And because this piece, I think, has such a kind of meditative beauty to it.
Yes. I think that's what made it so difficult to sing when you're small and pleasing Mr. Guest.
Thank you.
O Sacrum Convivium by Messiaen, the choir of St. John's College, Cambridge, directed by George Guest. Well, talking of Simon Hopkinson, cathedral acoustics, one of the organ composers that I remember turning pages for at the cathedral and just rejoicing in the sounds he make was Jean Alain.
Yeah, fantastically exciting organ piece. I mean, we began with organ and we're ending with organ, which is just lovely. And again, the rhythm of it is very exciting.
There's something about getting to the end of a service and everybody's breathing a slight sigh, and then you get the organist sort of lets loose. I mean, virtually does a kind of Jeremy Clarkson on the organ.
Well, there was a, certainly every term, even Song on a Sunday with the Howells or the Tippett at John's, and often it was a Sunday night where this particular piece, Litanies, would be played. And in fact, I think it was Jonathan Bealby on my last time in the choir, after my voice had broken, that I said, please would you play Litanies by Alain, because I would love to hear it for the last time.
Thank you. course, it's every chorister's delight, really, that a big crescendo with sort of Rossini-like build-up and pulling out more and more stops as you go along.
It's almost like every stop is in years, isn't it? And it's pushing and pushing, and it's very exciting.
And, of course, based on Gregorian Plain Chant, the tune.
Right. Yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
Like an awful lot of music. Thomas Trotter there, playing Litanies from Three Pieces by Jean Alain. Well, Simon, hot on the success of your series and book, are you going to be doing another one or another book?
We shall see what we shall see. Let them finish, and I hope that people will have enjoyed them. I've had some lovely things said about them, particularly from friends, about the series, and the book seems to be doing well.
Well, the great thing about doing what you do is that we all have to eat.
Yes, quite. And I always hope that people will eat very well. It may seem an obvious thing to say, but cooking is about eating. And sometimes I think that recipes are written and food is cooked, and there is sometimes a case for saying, do remember that the eating part is the most important.
You know. Thank you very much for this musical accompaniment to the meal, Simon Hopkinson.
Well, thank you for having me.
Simon Hopkinson was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week at the same time, there's another chance to hear the novelist Marina Levitska talking to Michael Barclay about her favourite music. That's next Sunday at midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper. Well, tonight's Sunday feature here on BBC Radio 3 takes us across the Atlantic to Detroit.
The start of their season is just days away, but instead of pleasing a full house, musicians with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra will be picketing.
Is it possible that we will never have a DSO in this city again, another Detroit Symphony Orchestra?
I couldn't imagine that.
For 6 months last winter, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra was silent. Its future hung in the balance during a bitter strike.
While General Motors went through their bankruptcy, Ford went through a near-death experience in that regard. I think the orchestra is right in the midst of that period themselves.
Actually, if I were to buy a lotto ticket and win, I'd still play in the Detroit Symphony because I love it.
Once one of the great American orchestras, the Detroit Symphony's journey parallels that of its hometown, now the epitome of U.S. urban decline. Symphony for Detroit.
Two biggest losers are the musicians and the people of Detroit.
This week's Radio 3 Sunday feature, starting at 9:30.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news read by David Cornett.
Scotland Yard has said it couldn't have predicted the extent of the rioting which broke out in North London last night, in which 26 of its officers were injured. More than 40 people were arrested after violence flared following a protest in Tottenham against the fatal shooting by police of a local man, Mark Duggan. Buildings and homes were set on fire, police cars were burnt out, and shops and banks were looted. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has said she condemns the riots utterly. Senior finance officials from the G7 countries have held telephone conference calls on the international debt crisis, as efforts continue to calm the markets before trading resumes tomorrow. Central bank governors of the 17 countries which use the euro will also hold emergency talks later this afternoon. They'll discuss whether the ECB should start buying up Italian and Spanish government bonds to help restore confidence in their finances. Opposition activists in Syria say government forces have launched attacks on two towns, killing at least 27 people. Eyewitnesses reported tanks storming the northeastern city of Deir ez-Zor after a heavy bombardment which began before dawn. The latest reports say many parts of the city are now under government control. In Afghanistan, investigations are continuing into yesterday's helicopter crash, which killed 38 people, mostly Americans. The United States Chinook was apparently shot down by a Taliban rocket. It was America's biggest single loss since their invasion of Afghanistan 10 years ago. The father of one of the four young men who were wounded by a polar bear which killed a teenager has been told they'll be flown back to the UK from Norway this afternoon. The parents of 17-year-old Horatio Chappell, who died in the attack, have described their son as strong, fearless and kind. And the weather, heavy rain with the risk of localised flooding across much of Scotland. Elsewhere, it'll be windy with a mixture of sunshine and showers. Top temperature, 20 degrees Celsius. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now on Radio 3, today's Early Music Show, and Catherine Bott reflects on a further highlight from this year's York Early Music Festival.
A summer evening in York, and a contented and discerning audience is emerging from one of the city's many churches and the third concert of the day in the 2011 York Early Music Festival. They've already been treated to a lunchtime selection of 18th century Yorkshire ballads and an early evening display of songs, reading and dances by Playford and Purcell. And day six of the festival has ended with contemplative, mesmeric, sacred choral music from the first decades of the 16th century, performed by the 12 young voices of the Brabant Ensemble, directed by Stephen Rice. The church of St Michael le Belfry, hard by the Minster, was built on the site of a derelict medieval church and completed in 1536. Much later in the century, Guy Fawkes was baptised there. But when the music in this concert was new, so was St Michael's. The Brabant Ensemble specialises in 16th century masterpieces, and founder director Stephen Rice delights in digging out the work of lesser-known composers. Their programme demonstrated the contrasts and convergences of musical styles in three European countries whose mighty monarchs were jockeying for position in the early 16th century. Henry VIII of England, his Spanish father-in-law, Ferdinand of Aragon, and François I of France. And the singers began in France with music by Pierre Moulu. The title is very conventional, Mater Floreat, May the Mother Flourish. But it's not the Marian tribute you might expect, rather a witty, punning list of French musical movers and shakers. Bunois, Obrecht, Compère, Brumel, Isaac, the incomparable Josquin, Mouton with the Golden Fleece.
Thank you.
The Brabant Ensemble, directed by Stephen Rice, beginning their concert in the 2011 York Early Music.